Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we are going to talk elk, and I have Jake Long with us on, and we're going to talk a little bit about how he does it. You know, everybody's very caught up, especially nowadays, pushing the bugling and the calling in elk and so on and so forth, and Jake's got a different approach. He's been very successful guiding and for himself on elk with his style. So what's going on, Jake? How are you?
Oh, I'm doing good. Just got off a pretty long shift at the fire department yesterday, so a little tired this morning, but that's part of the business.
Yeah, I can imagine. What do you do, like 412s or...
No, we do, it's called a modified Kelly. So we do, 3 24-hour shifts with a break, a day off between those three shifts. And then at the end of your third shift, you get 4 days off. Oh, so it's like 10 days a month. So I get 20 days off a month to go play in the mountains and
yeah.
Go check out the critters.
Oh yeah. That's a good setup. I got it pretty good myself, mainly because as long as I have cell phone service, I can kind of run my business.
Nice.
Yeah, there's been many times when I'm out on a hunt and I'm stalking an animal and my phone starts going buzzing in my pocket and I've had to answer it and be like, okay, take care of this like that. You know?
Yep.
Back in the pocket, back on the stalk, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
But it's nice because it affords me a lot of time in the field, and also I have a lot of time with the family and all that stuff. So that's why my wife and kids aren't as affected by my hunting because I'm always around. You know, I'm here in the mornings with my kids, and I'm here when they get home from school. And I'm the one that takes them soccer practice and
nice.
All that stuff. So yeah, that's kind of a neat gig. I complain about it all the time, but.
Yep. No, I hear you. It like not sleeping for, 36 straight hours, pretty routinely kind of wears you down, but
yeah.
You get as much flexibility with your schedule as we do. The pros definitely outweigh the cons, and we get, I'm taking off 2 months this fall to guide, and there's not many jobs out there you can take that much time off in a row and go do the things that you enjoy.
Yeah, that's for sure. Plus you guys got really good retirement benefits. It's like the job. I got cousins that are firefighters in New York, and it's like, it's hard to beat that, the pension, and like you said, the flexibility and whatnot.
Yeah.
Well, so give us a little bit more about yourself and, how you fit into the whole hunting scene here.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm, 39. I live on the western slope of Colorado, and I've made Colorado my home the last 20 years. Bopped around quite a bit with my parents. They're military, so we had that fun childhood bouncing to schools every other year, and grew up in Northeast Oregon with, in like prime elk habitat, and routinely missing school with my dad, running around the mountains chasing elk and birds and predators and you name it. We were out trapping all winter. And so, yeah, I had a pretty awesome childhood just living it and getting that addiction and that passion for it. And now I'm on the western slope of Colorado, and I consider it the mecca of like elk hunting and deer hunting. And we're pretty centrally located to all the western states, so it's easy, yeah. Easy road trip to go hunt Utah, Arizona, Wyoming, any place over here. It's just, perfect.
Nice. Yeah, I haven't hunted Colorado in a while. But I've always enjoyed my hunts there. It's beautiful country, game rich, you know. I have a very good chance at drawing the deer tag that I want this year.
Nice.
So we'll see. We'll see how that works.
It'll be a good year to draw one for sure with, you know, our snowpack and our moisture this year. I think it'll be a good horn growth year. And, you know,
yeah.
I got deer that live behind my house year round. And I mean, they all look super fat and healthy. And I think it's going to be a great year to have some tags.
Nice. Yeah. I'll send a couple of more Hail Mary up there. Maybe I'll draw it. So we briefly opened with you know, your style. You're more of a ambush style elk hunter. I'd like to hear how are you patterning them? How are you what are you doing for your scouting to locate them and begin the process of what you do?
Sure. So like we talked about, my job gives me a lot of flexibility. And so I'm in the mountains year round. I'm keeping tabs on elk year round. I'm pretty much like just an elk nut. I don't, look for deer too often. And so I just kind of get a 360 view of what the elk are doing. I know where they winter. I know their transitional areas. I know where they generally bed, what they're eating, their water sources, their wallows. I just kind of, make this 360 degree, pattern of them throughout the year. And I think that's played a huge part of my success, is just having a general idea of where they generally go, where they water, all their little hidden hidey holes. And so I have this big, picture of, what they're doing, where they transition. And so that's kind of what I've used, just scouting 365 to understand what the elk do around here. And it translates basically anywhere you go. You can kind of see a flow path of where these elk will summer. You can kind of predict where they're going to go in the winter, even if you haven't been to that area before. And then it just kind of opens up these, places to scout and look for their trails and bedding areas. And then you can just kind of find these little pinch points where you can set up, and with pretty good success, you can predict them to come through at, any given point. And I mean, it's just a very successful way of taking out elk.
Nice. So let me ask you some questions that clarify the stuff that you said. So, basically, once you've spent a lot of time learning the patterns of elk, you're saying that you should be able to take that knowledge and replicate it in other areas by looking for the same types of landscape features, same types of vegetation, watering, bedding.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, once you kind of figure out their mentality, what they're looking for, and then you add in if there's pressure, no pressure, where you're hunting, you can very quickly within a day or two kind of narrow down a spot where the elk are. And then I like to sit back, watch, try to figure out what they're doing. And then you can pattern the elk. I mean, they're pretty patternable. They do the same thing if they're not pressured. And you know, I try to find those little pockets where they go if they are pressured and watch them, and then you can set up a pretty good ambush, and it works really well.
Yeah. Wow. All right. I'm going to be a little nitpicky on this, because I know there's a lot of people that are listening to this that are kind of painting a picture in their head, but then there's a lot of guys that are like, okay, that's just so vague, I can't, or so broad, I can't see it exactly. Can you try to, like, so to see pressured elk, obviously you'd have to wait till hunting season, or are you like watching like during your heavy camping months, or what are you doing to kind of figure that out?
Well, most of the areas I hunt are like, I wait till after the opener, because that's where all the elk get pushed into and nobody else wants to go in there.
Got it.
So it's very predictable that after the opener, and you get all your guys running down the ridges and, you know, getting half a mile from the ATV or truck, it's very predictable to find these little pockets of elk. And if you're willing to hike a little bit further and glass a little bit longer, you can find these pockets of elk that once they're in their little sanctuary, they very rarely get messed with. Like, and so those are the pockets that I'm finding, and then I'll sit back and I'm not going to just run and gun in there generally. Sometimes I will, but generally I'll sit back and watch them, figure where they're, you know, watch them bed, watch where they go eat. You can kind of predict where they're going to go water if you can't glass it up. Generally they water at night, so you'll see them where they're generally moving. You can predict that there's water down there, and then, you know, at night they will move their way back up towards their bedding area. And so I just kind of get that picture and see that little flow of their movement, and then I can get a good game plan, a very predictable game plan, where I can go into this certain spot depending on the wind, and most likely I'm going to have an opportunity at something.
Gotcha. So you started saying about, you know, they generally do this and they generally do that. Just, you know, obviously it's just as a rule of thumb. Take us through what you've witnessed or what you've noticed that elk do from morning to night, as far as their typical pattern.
So generally in the morning they're going to be, you know, feeding, and then they're going to ride those currents up. So elk always want the wind in their face. So you'll see that when that wind switches, that they're going to be walking into the wind, which creates it, a difficulty if you're like trying to cut them off. But when you watch their pattern, you can come in from the side and
right. Hit them perpendicularly as opposed
And there's like, you got to learn your area, you know, and figure out at what time does the wind switch, and, you know, have that in your head and know when the wind's going to be swirling. And then you got to kind of predict at, you know, I need to be at this spot no sooner than this, no later than that. And then that's going to give me that little window right into the herd.
Right. Oh, that's smart. Okay. So they're riding it up, and then they to their bedding area. If they're in their bedding area, they're typically there for, I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, they're there most of the day, especially during archery season. They'll get up and kind of shift around a bit. If they're rutting hard, you will see them, you know, go get water in the middle of the day when most people are back at their camps Middle of the day is actually a really good time to be sitting water holes or wallows, because those bulls, you know, if they're rutting hard all night, they're going to be exhausted. They're going to be dehydrated and they're going to go take a nap, and then they're going to sneak down to that water source, cool off, water up, and then they're going to go right back to their girls. So once I leave in the morning, I don't come back till after dark, and mid-morning is a great, great time to be sitting on water and waiting for those bulls to, you know, drink up. Once they go back to their bed, I generally won't mess with them in their bed unless, you know, it's just like this perfect opportunity, because once you blow them out, it's going to be 2 or 3 days before you can, you know, get this whole thing figured out, this puzzle. And then, you know, that's a lot of time and energy that you're going to put into it. And then evenings too, you know, they're going to get up, start milling around, feeding, and generally they'll water again at night. So those water sources are really key to know where they're at and their routes in and out of those water sources, and then having, you know, build like a little ground blind at them or a tree stand, and having that as one of your major ambush points seems to work pretty good.
Nice. Now, you had mentioned pinch points, like locating pinch points. Describe to me what, you know, try to paint a picture as best you can. Obviously, we don't have video going here or the ability to see what you're looking at. But describe to me what a pinch point is for you and what it is that you're looking for in it.
Just kind of a path that they're going to have to take to get to their bedding areas or down to water. On the western slope here, we have a lot of cliff bands and real nasty country, and it forces them to go on specific trails. Okay. Or if there's a lot of blowdown, you know, they don't want to walk through that stuff. So it will kind of funnel them into these little corridors, and you'll find those trails and they'll just be beaten down. And if you can, you know, find a good spot that your wind's going to be good and you can sit just a little ways off that trail system, you have a very high likelihood of something coming by. And so that's kind of what I was talking about with the pinch points, is just finding those little, their main corridors or their travel routes that you can predict them to come through, and sitting on those.
So, I mean, at face value of everything that you've said so far, it seems to me that you have to invest a lot of time to hunt this way. If somebody was to come out, you know, I'm only coming out, I have a 7-day hunt planned. Obviously, I'm not going to have time to get out there and scout and so on and so forth. Do you think it's possible? And if so, can you explain to us the things that you would do if you were just going somewhere, like a different state that you hadn't had time to scout?
Yeah. What I'd recommend is getting there a few days before the season opens, and finding a pocket of animals before things get, you know, crazy. I'd always take scouting days over hunting days, especially, you know, in Colorado. I mean, we have a lot of pressure. There's a lot of tags. I mean, they're unlimited during second and third rifle. So if you have a game plan and you're, you know, 3 steps ahead of everybody else before the season kicks off, and you have some elk kind of pattern, and you can be there opening morning, I mean, I've killed a lot of elk the first day or two of the season. And, you know, I'm gone before most people have even found the first elk.
Right.
And so I would always do that. But what I'd also say too is stick with a unit. Like if you're only coming out for 7 days, it might not work out your first trip or your second trip, but if you keep coming back to the same area and learning that area, and, you know, it might take two or three different seasons, but eventually you're going to have this big picture and you're going to have all these different seasons and all types of different weather that comes through that's going to do a little something else to those elk. You're going to have this really big view of what that specific unit and that specific area and those elk will do. And then that third season, you're going to tag out in the fourth season and so on and so forth. You're just going to have like a lot of intel on that area, and you're going to do so much better than bouncing around and chasing, you know, like greener grass on the other side of the fence, you know. And
right.
I think that's super important.
So actually, you led me to another question that I was thinking about, as far as weather is concerned. So, you know, you've been doing most of your scouting early season or whatever, and then, you know, come opening week, weather's completely different. There's snow, let's say, or I'd like you to kind of, let's look at wind, super hot, and cold and snowy, and tell me how you think, pick one of them, start with one of those, and how you think that affects the elk or what you've seen that how it affects the elk anyway.
Well, definitely early season, you know, the heat, you know, it wears those elk out, and they don't want to move around. They're going to be pretty nocturnal. Or they're going to be way up high. They're going to be above tree line, trying to keep cool, trying to keep the bugs off. Your windows of opportunity are going to be smaller, I'd say, generally. They're going to, you know, spend their time at night feeding and moving around. And then water is going to be a huge thing, but they're definitely more likely to water during the middle of the day, during the early seasons when it's hot. You know, they're on a cycle. And if you've ever looked at that hunt fish time on your GPS, it is crazy accurate. Like if you follow that and it says, you know, hunting time is going to be good between 11 a.m. to noon.
Yep.
I mean, it is like eerie how effective that is. Like you will, like it'll be 11 o'clock and the elk stand up. It's kind of weird, but it's legit. And if you follow that and like have their water source and, you know you're looking on those north side slopes where it's cooler and they can, you know get their temperature down, you're gonna be way ahead. And then conversely, like when it snows and it's nasty out, those elk are going to be out longer. They have to fuel up. They have to stay warm. So they have to eat. Water is not going to be in, you know, really on their radar. They're going to get that through the snow. You'll see them eat snow. They're going to get the moisture through the food, but they're going to be out longer eating. They'll get up midday too and eat around their bedding area. So, and it's great. Like if you can weather a storm, like I love nasty storms, because if you can just sit it out for, you know, a day or two, that day when it opens up is like Christmas. The elk are everywhere. They are hungry. They're trying to dry off, and they are just, they pop up everywhere. It's like Christmas.
I'm so happy to hear that you follow, that you look at that. I use that all the time. I look at the barometer, and I look at I look at that, you know, major feeding times and so on and so forth. I use this. It's on the Scoutlook weather app also. I use that one, and that one seems to be really accurate. And I got into it because of whitetail hunting. Whitetail hunters live and die by that stuff. Huh. And I found that it works great with mule deer. It works great with coos deer. It works great with elk. It's very, very accurate. And the other thing I've noticed was moon phase. What are your takes on moon phase?
I haven't really followed it, honestly. Like, that's one part of my game that I should work on. It does seem like full moons, they do feed longer during the middle of the night. But it does open up opportunities midday. So they're just like us. They want to eat, you know, every, say, 6 hours. So if they were eating all night and they went to bed right at daylight, they're going to get hungry around noon or whenever, you know, that hunt fish time tells you they're going to eat. They're going to eat. They have to get up and they have to eat. And so, like, I don't really pay attention to the moon phases because I know there's opportunities even with full moons or no moons. It just changes it a slight bit, but you're still going to have opportunities. If you're up early, you're glassing, you're trying to get a pattern down, you're going to see some opportunities there, and then you just adapt to the situation.
Right. You have to. I mean, listen, let's put it this way. There's a lot of hunts out there that you only have 10 days to hunt. You know, so you really can't pay attention to moon. You can't, like, say, oh, I'm not going hunting because
you're
full moon or whatever. But it's, I always look at the moon because it, for me, I've noticed, like, especially with elk, I've noticed when it's hot, and we get that a lot here in Arizona, when it's really hot and we have a full moon. It's really hard. They, like, go to sleep. Like, I mean, they go to their beds, like, first light, they're gone, you know? And like you said, there is some midday action and whatnot. And then it seems that, like, where you would have like 2 or 3 hours in the morning and 2 or 3 hours in the evening gets cut back to like an hour, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes less.
Sometimes less. And, so if I can avoid full moons, I do. Now, later in the season, when it's, you know, late season, we're not talking about rutting activity and whatnot, and the temperature is not a problem. Like, I don't feel like the full moon, if anything, you know, the weather has more to do with everything than anything else. Like, the full moon doesn't really affect it. It's, you know, it's like one of the, I think it has to be a conjunction with, like, really hot weather and, or really dry and hot, especially, where it really has a profound effect on the elk.
So. Yeah. And then, yeah, with the rut involved in there somewhere, and then with pressure too, there's just all these different variables that will, you know, kind of dictate what those elk are going to do. And you just have to be able to sit back and watch and figure out what the current situation is. And then you can get that game plan.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about these late season hunts and some of the differences. You know, we've been primarily talking about early season to an extent. You pretty much have to rely on this style of hunting and glassing, rather, you know, during the late season hunt, because you don't have the ability to call or, you know, locate bugling and so on and so forth. How do some of the things change, and what are some of the things that you're doing to be successful during those late hunts?
Yeah, I love late season hunts. One, there's not many people out there. Like, we have a fourth rifle hunt here, which is just awesome. Everyone's like hiding in their homes and no one's out there backpacking in. So it's like, it's very easy to get away from people. But it can be difficult to find those little bachelor groups of bulls that are hiding in the timber. So it takes, you just need really good glass. You need really good technique on glassing. And you got to be persistent, because you might glass, you know, 2 or 3 days before you eventually find that small little group of bachelor bulls. And those bulls, they're not going to move, you know, 100 yards, 200 yards. They might not move from where they're bedding.
Right.
So it can be really difficult to find them. But once you find them, it's basically game over. Mm-hmm. As long as you make a good game plan and approach and you're smart about it, it's game over. You get to pick the biggest bull in the group, and then that's it. You're going to go home with, you know, a potentially a really nice bull that you might not have ever seen during the earlier seasons because he was nocturnal. But now he's in survival mode and he has to eat to stay warm so he doesn't die.
Refresh my memory. What time of year is that that fort season?
It's basically the second week of November.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. Because I remember looking into it, and I was like, oh, crap. I run rut mule deer hunts in South Dakota, basically that second. And then the first week, beginning of the second week of November. And because I wanted to do that hunt, a good buddy of mine, Brian Smith, had told me about coming out to do that. And I was like, yeah, man, I want to do that. And then, but it just never works out for me because I run hunts at basically exact same time of year that goes on.
Oh,
I'll have to put something together. I mean, I don't always have to be the guide out there. I can send some of my guys to go take care of it, but typically I'm usually the guy that's guiding it because I know it the best. I it's definitely a hunt that I want to take advantage of.
You guys have the best late season hunts. Like, that's what I always put in for is those late Arizona hunts. And I've drawn twice down there, and man, it's a kick in the butt. Like, late season, there's nothing going on here, and it's the same deal. Like, you got to burn your eyes out to find those bulls, and
right,
man, it's awesome.
Yeah, I like the late season. There's a few. I shouldn't say I like them all, but there's a few units that I love to hunt late season. I've done the late season archery elk hunt here twice myself. I've guided it a few times as well. I've gotten two late season bulls during the archery season.
Nice.
2011, and then again in 2016. And it's basically just like hunting deer for me. I mean, I look for those areas that I know that I can glass. And you know, most Arizona guys are, you know, if they're having success out here, they're usually excellent glassers. And, you know, we spend so much time looking for little itty bitty coos deer, you know, crawling through the brush to glass up elk is pretty easy. So I love those units where I can glass. I know guys that have a lot of success, you know, hunting over water and stuff, but I don't know. For me, I've never liked, it's so funny because I'm such an avid whitetail hunter and I could sit in a tree stand all day long, whitetail woods, but like, to hunt something else out of a tree stand or a ground blind, I have such a hard time doing it. And I don't know why that is, but I do. And I know some water holes that just get pounded too. It's like, mm-hmm. not like, you know, they don't have success. It's just, I don't know, man. It's just a mental block I can't seem to get over. But
yeah, I agree. It is hard. Like, some of the ambush stuff is real hard. Like, the patience, I don't have a whole lot, but you know, it's worth it. It's like, I definitely love running and gunning. That's my preferred method. But like, right. I think the more successful way is the ambush style.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I like glass and stalk is actually my preferred. I do a lot of spot and ambush also, where I glass them up, and just like you know, you spend a lot of time around them. You understand where they're going, how they're using the terrain, you know, so on and so forth. And I try to go to where I think they're going to and cut them off. I do that with deer as well. Only because I'm not really good at stalking. I'm a little impatient. I move a little too quickly. I'm not really so much that I'm loud, but I definitely push it too much. So spot and ambush has always worked for me.
Yeah. I'm kind of the same way too, as these guys talking about 3-hour stalks, and I'm like, man, like, that is some serious patience. Like, I got to get in there and get a shot, and like, I'm not patient enough to do like some of these stalks that these guys are doing. It's crazy impressive what some guys can do, for sure.
Yeah, no, I have friends that are just like, I mean, it's so impressive to me that how much patience they have. You know, I've done it myself a few times, and I feel like every time that I do it, it never pays off for me, you know? Like, yeah. I sat one time, I was a coos deer buck, and I was hunting with my mentor at the time, Dwayne Adams, and I had a leg full of jumping choya, which is a nasty cactus. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yep.
I'm sitting 2.5 hours with this, like, just stuck in my leg. And I was like, if I, you know, try to sit here and pull this stuff out, and I was sitting 60 yards away from this buck and this doe, just waiting for this buck to stand up. And, yeah, he finally stands up, and I draw back and I shoot, and I guess I didn't see this branch. I don't know, whatever, but I hit a branch, deflected the arrow downwards a little bit. And so I just kind of caught him, basically in the leg is where I got him. I got him in the leg, and, you know, basically where the leg and the body meet. Like, so I really didn't catch much of his, and I didn't catch any vitals, you know? And then, you know, he ran off and he bed down like a couple hundred yards away. And I, you know, I stalked in on him again, and I never could get another shot. We went back in the next morning, and he would have been the biggest buck I had ever shot. And
bummer. Yeah. I mean, that happens, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately. So, that actually, was what I was going to ask you next, is if you could share, one of your favorite, elk hunting stories, if you could paint the picture of, you know, how you located them, how you got in on them, and the whole nine yards.
Yeah, I was just trying to think of one. I had a cool one down in Arizona. It was my first tag I drew down there, and the Eastmans had it as like a red unit, like, don't waste your time, yada yada yada.
Yeah,
but I just want tags. I don't care really the size of the bull or, you know, the unit. I'm not going to ever draw one of these, like, you know, epic trophy units, because I'm just not patient enough to wait that long. I want to hunt. And so I drew this really cool late season, like, I think it was the first week of December, hunt down there. And So I just jumped in my truck solo, ran down there, got in the unit, like pitch dark, like midnight or something. It's pretty long drive from here. And there's like 2 feet of snow. And I'm like, what the hell? I thought I was in Arizona. And it's just cold, like single digits at night. And I'm freezing in my truck. I wasn't quite anticipating that in Arizona. So caught me off a little guard, but I'd done a bunch of research on Google Earth. So I had a bunch of little game plans in my head where I thought I could get away from roads and find some pockets. And so I hiked into some, you know, road closure areas, and I got up to some good glassing points and started doing my thing, and bam, like just first spot I picked, this big old bull popped out, and I'm like, holy crap, Arizona's like the shit. And so I watched this bull, and it was just daylight, like just able to glass. And I see this, you know, probably the biggest bull I'd seen, you know, out hunting. And all of a sudden he picks his head up and he runs off the mountain. I'm like, what the hell? Like, I'm like so pissed. I thought somebody had spooked him or something, but it's 2 days before the opener and there wasn't a lot of people out in right. that unit yet. And so I was kind of pissed. And so I bumped out and, you know, went scouted a couple different units and cut a bunch of tracks and, you know, followed some tracks and tried to get, you know, five or six different plan Bs.
Right.
And then I backpacked or hiked back into this area. I saw that bull and sat there till dark, never came out. So I'm like, well, that's the last time I ever going to see him. Hiked back to the truck again, like super cold that night. Woke up, hiked, you know, back to my point, sat there. Sure enough, here's that bull again, like on this little face. It wasn't very big, but there's some grass up there. So out he comes. I'm like, heck yeah, you know, I'm getting some video and some footage on my phone. And like, he picks his head up like, I don't know, 10 minutes after shooting light, and he runs off the mountain. I'm like, holy crap, they raise him smart down here. I never seen a bull do that before. And I was like, man, this guy's going to be pretty hard to shoot, you know? So I go scout the unit again, kind of, you know, find a couple other elk and get back there. And, you know, he doesn't show up that night again. I'm like, huh. So, you know, just trying to build that like pattern and try to get that game plan. So that next morning's opener, I sneak in there, I cut that distance way down, I get across the canyon from where he's going to come out, and sitting there, and boom, here comes an elk. And it's just this little raghorn that I'd never seen before. And I'm like, what the heck? And then here comes that big bull, and he made like one step out into this clearing, and boom, I didn't give him 5 seconds to get out of there, and just dumped him. And yeah, it was just like so cool to go to, like, never hunted Arizona, never been in that unit, but I used all the stuff I've learned from around here and put it in play down there, and found this old freaking clever bull and got it done opening morning. And I was back home that night having dinner with my wife. So pretty fast wild hunt, but it was really fun.
Nice. Yeah, it's funny, those late season, I mean, a lot of times they're broke up, but I've seen some of the biggest bulls on that late archery hunt, not on the rifle hunt though, because especially lately they've been putting so many damn tags in that late season. It's like it's like a zoo. And you know, people talk about getting away from roads. Problem with Arizona is there's freaking roads everywhere, you know.
Yeah,
you got some of these, you know, got some wilderness areas and whatnot, but a lot of these hunts don't have roadless areas, you know. There's roads going every which direction in elk country especially. Yeah, that It could be a really good hunt. If you could share with us a story where you learned something and something on how you maybe that kind of led you to the way you hunt today or changed the way you hunt, that would be awesome.
I think just like everyone, you know, it's always a learning process. And I remember like in my early 20s going out and I had my, you know, Primo's bugle and my, what's that?
You still there?
Can you hear me?
Well,
hello?
Did I lose you?
Can you hear me? Or
yeah, now I can hear you. Yeah, I couldn't hear you for the last like 20 seconds.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah, just kind of, I couldn't hear you either.
I'll edit all that out. It's not a big deal.
Okay.
So if you need another.
So I was just saying like everybody, it's a learning process. In my early 20s, just running out there with my Primo's bugle and my cow calls and just running and bugling and, you know, doing everything wrong and, you know, having heartache after heartache and, you know, eating tag soup year after year. And, you know, it's just that persistence and that drive to be the 10%. Like somebody said, you know, 10% of the hunters kill 100% of the elk. And that like kind of resonated with me. And I was like, dang, they're right. Like, the successful people are doing something different and they are always successful. And so that's kind of when it changed my mindset, is I need to be in this. And, you know, I was reading a bunch of magazines and books and like hearing all these stories and tactics. And I was like, man, I was just walking armed in the woods, you know, scaring everything away, walking through bedding zones and like, sounding horrible on a bugle and no wonder I didn't kill anything or get killed, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you just gotta be a student of the game and you have to be willing to put in, you know, the time reading, you know, educating yourself. But I think the most important thing is just getting out there and doing it and not being afraid to fail and, you know, get out there, put yourself out there and just do it. Like, you can't kill anything being at home or, you know, this piece of gear is not going to help you kill anything. It's you out there and you got to put in the time and effort and you got to learn from your mistakes. And if you're not willing to like take advice or read something or change something, you're just going to continue to make the same mistakes. And I did that for a long time. So, you know, it's a long process, but once things start clicking, it just gets so fun. And now I'm taking, you know, kids and my wife and buddies, and I'm getting, you know, all my friends up there and I'm getting everyone their first elk. And I enjoy that probably more than taking elk myself anymore. And it's just a real fun process. Like, you know, going from hunter to mentor to guide to, you know, that whole process is super fun.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's I haven't felt that it was equally rewarding yet, but I feel that it's pretty darn well, you know, with my kids. Well, my kids haven't, but I feel like it once my kids are able to take their first big game animal, that'll be different. But I've like nephews and you know, well, uncles and all that stuff, and that I've felt that it's almost the same, you know.
Yeah,
for sure. Clients, not yet. That hasn't quite.
It's a little different. I had a good story with my wife. Like, she shot her first bull and it was like a nice 6x6 bull, and she hammered this bull and she's like, I'm like, it's standing there. It didn't drop. And I was like, well, shoot it again. She turns at me and looks at me and her hand's shaking so bad. She's like, I'm shaking too bad. I can't get another shot. You shoot it. And I was like, see, that right there is why I'm so passionate about this, is that feeling, like that sense of accomplishment and years and years and years and miles, and you finally, it all comes together. And it's like just the most gratifying thing that you can do, in my opinion. It's like, holy cow. That, oh, you, when you see your kids shoot one, you're going to be like, holy cow. Yeah, this is better than shooting them myself.
Awesome. Yeah, I can't wait. My eldest Ella, she got her first big game tag this year, which was a javelina. But hopefully, nice. I'll draw her a deer tag, and we'll be able to get one done with the rifle. She had a ham hunt, which was handgun archery muzzleloader, and the muzzleloader she really couldn't shoot it. Unfortunately, I mean, she can. She's laying down. She can shoot it. And where we were hunting wasn't very conducive. The grass is always super tall. So, yeah. So she used a crossbow. And
nice.
Yeah. But we got in on him a couple of times. We only hunted really, it was really like a day and a half. And she got on, we got on three different herds, and she was right there and just couldn't make it happen. And she was so bummed out. But, I think if we could get a coos deer hunt or something this year, we'll be able to make it happen.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, cool, man. I enjoyed your take on things, and, I think it gives the listeners a lot of food for thought. You know, the more tools you could add to your repertoire, you know, so to speak, the better off you're going to be. Because even if you like to do the run and gun calling, you know, style and that type of hunting, you know, all the stuff that you have said is just going to help make that so much better. Because you could still, you know, pattern them and get in close and then call them in, you know, like you're going to have way more success. In my opinion, that way.
So. Yeah, absolutely. It's a never ending learning process. And the more you can gain and experience, the better you're going to be. And, you know, it's just a fun process. I love it. It's, you know, it's the giant chess game, and those critters are, I mean, they're crazy smart, and it's just a great, fun challenge to try to match wits with them.
Absolutely. Well, awesome, man. Thanks for coming on. Real quick, where can our listeners find out more about you?
Probably Instagram. That's where, I don't do much on Facebook anymore. So Instagram is elkhunter34. You can follow some of my hunts on there, my guiding up in Alaska, and some of my pack goat stuff. So,
sweet. Well, we'll talk soon, man. Thanks for coming on, and hope you have a good season.
Thanks, man. You too.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. Bye.
Hey, guys, just a couple of quick closing thoughts. If you want to stay connected with the podcast, check out my blog, johnstallone.me. That's johnstallone.me. And it's a nice place to catch all my articles, game recipes, workouts, all kinds of good stuff that goes hand in hand with the podcast. Another thing I want to talk to you about is if you're looking for a safe place to be part of a community on social media, I want you to go and check out Broadhead Nation on Facebook. If you're not already a member, it's a nice place where everybody should feel comfortable to ask questions, to be part of a community. They do a really good job. That's Broadhead Nation on Facebook. Check it out.